You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hey, everybody. Chris Webster here, founder of the Archaeology Podcast Network. And during this winter season, we are taking a little bit of a break and using this opportunity to present you with episodes from shows that you may not be aware of. Today's episode is from And My Trowel, episode 43, and it's hosted by Tilly and Ash. And in this episode, it's called Weaving Our Own Fates. They cover all kinds of different things in Norse mythology. So check this podcast out wherever you find podcasts. If you don't subscribe, and please do, on to the show.
You have my sword.
And you have my bow.
And my trowel.
Hi, you're listening to episode 43 of And My Trowel, where we look at the fantastic side of archaeology and the archaeological side of fantasy. I'm Ash.
And I'm Tilly.
And today, we have a bit of a fateful quest to delve into.
Oh, now, would you say this quest is perhaps predestined? Kismet woven into the stars, the very fabric of our world?
Oh, you've been reading my pigeon post again, haven't you?
I might have peaked, but only because it was addressed to both of us, and you know that that pigeon has no sense of direction.
Okay, fine, but you've spoiled the surprise now.
Sorry.
Do you want to tell listeners about today's quest, then?
Yes, I do. Okay, so we are going to become the Norns. Well, temporarily, at least.
Yes, we were recommended. You might remember that we did some work for the Asgard Yuletide Committee around wintertime regarding the World Tree replacement, and so they've reached out again to ask if we'll cover the Norns' duties while they take a well-needed holiday.
I can't wait! Imagine us, the masters of fate, weaving intricate patterns that shape the lives of gods and humans.
Not so fast, Tilly. There's a problem.
Ugh, why is there always a problem?
Well, actually, there's two major problems. Oh. The first is that there's only two of us, okay? And we need three Norns.
Right.
There's three, okay?
Okay.
The second is that we don't actually know how to weave, let alone weave fate.
Yeah, that's a good point. Wait, I mean, have the Norns left us anything to work with? Like, I don't know, a piece of woven fate or a thread of life or something?
Wait. I did see something knocking around here. Yes, here it is. Aha. So, there's some warp ends.
Oh.
So, we do have some woven fabric to work with, but we need another person to make us a trio.
Well, have no fear, Ash, because I know the perfect person. Welcome to our guest for this episode, prehistoric archaeologist and textile specialist, Ronja Lau. Yay, applause.
Yay. Oh, amazing.
Yay, lovely to meet you, Ronja. So, will you be our third Norn?
Oh, well, nothing can stop me. I would love to.
Awesome.
Yes. Fantastic. So, first of all, Ronja, what is your archaeological specialism and how did you get into it?
Oh, well, that's the crucial question, I know. I am a textile archaeologist, so I studied prehistoric archaeology, but I specialized onto textiles, actually. And I'm doing now Iron Age textiles, so Celtic ones from Austria. And I got into that, by fate.
Hopefully. Oh, how ironic.
Something, something was pulling me into the direction of, textile and weaving and crafts. And I really enjoyed that. So, I did that since my master's. And now I'm doing my PhD, actually, on Iron Age salt mine textiles. Thankfully, I have this very great topic to work on.
And were you interested in like textile stuff before? Like, did you already do, I don't know, weaving and sewing or something? And that's what got you into it? Or was it really just a random, oh, this looks like a cool topic?
It was actually a good combination of hobby and work, because I was doing living history and reenactment quite a long time before I was doing archaeology, actually. And I enjoyed, creating clothing and textiles and learning textile craft so much that I thought, well, I can somehow combine this also with archaeology and research old crafts and techniques and also recreate and reconstruct, for example, like prehistoric clothing. So there was actually, a bit of fate to combine all of my interests also in my work.
So you really are a Norn.
Yeah, right? I'm like, we have a perfect guest. So you mentioned you're currently working on Iron Age textiles from a salt mine in Austria. So what? Tell us more. Tell us, what do you mean? You're working on textiles from a salt mine in Austria? So how does that work?
That's strange, isn't it? No, that's actually very simple, because here in Austria, we have actually two prehistoric salt mines, which have been in use actually from the Bronze Age. So you cool. may know Hallstatt. This is
Yeah, I wonder what that is.
The most famous one. But right next to it, actually just 40 kilometers away, there's a second salt mine, which is called Dürnberg. And the second salt mine, the Dürnberg, is a bit younger. It was used from the Hallstatt period to the Latin period. So it was like late to Middle Iron Age. And they used the salt mine, of course, to dig out some salt for trade. And they were quite rich due to the salt trade they did back then. And they lived on top of the mountain where the salt mine is. So we have a settlement, we have a graveyard, and we also have the working areas where they were working in the salt mine. And, you know, people leave trash behind, as we all know. And they also left a lot of trash in the salt mine. And they're, you know, ripped off sleeves, some fabric remains, but also like wood and leather. And because of the very good preservation conditions inside the salt mine, because of the salt, everything that is organic is preserved very, very well. So we have the perfect conditions for textiles, which are, of course, made out of wool and linen and other organic material. And they still look like new, but they are almost like 2,500 years old. So I have now maybe over 600 different textiles from the salt mine. And I research all the different textile characteristics to see how did they look like, what textiles did they made, and how did they, managed to put everything inside the salt mine. Yeah.
I had no idea that salt was a conservator for texture. Like, I don't know, in my mind I would be like, oh, if clothing got too much salt on it, it would just disintegrate.
Yeah, but you have to think about that, of course, salt conserves also, for example, for us in our modern times, mostly meat and other food. Yes. Mm-hmm. And this is all organic. These are all proteins. And the proteins get conserved by the salt because the lack of bacteria is more or less the bigger factor here. So the bacteria is not that interested in any organic stuff if there's a lot of salt around it. That works for wool because wool is also just a protein. Just animal protein, but also for plant remains like wood, because it draws out the water, of course, of the objects. And that is also a good, way to preserve organic stuff.
So you can you see the dye as well? Can you look at the dye through that?
What?
Yeah, they're very colorful.
Yeah. I love it when we find color.
That's probably also the most important part about this area of textile research, because in more cases when we find textiles, we can no longer see the dye because it either is, from a bog and it's discolored, or it's, not very good condition. But in the salt mine, the dye and the textiles, all the patterns are very well visible, and we can make a lot of analysis to see what dyes they also used for the textiles.
So cool.
That is very cool. Because, you do get some very bright colors like madder red and... I just got madder red. And then I completely forgot the other one.
Anyway, Lovey's brown. No, that's something else.
There's weld, woad.
Yes.
Woad, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. Yeah, these are the main dye plants, but there's of course more.
Yes, lots. So it does sound like you really, really enjoy your work then.
Oh, I do. Yeah, it's a great passion, and I'm very thankful to work on these finds and to make this hopefully my PhD at the end of next year, maybe. But yeah, it's great fun.
And in terms of kind of textile archaeology itself, from what I've heard from chatting with you before, but also from other people who are involved in textiles archaeology, it seems to be quite a small group still, quite a small field. Is that the case? Or would you say it's kind of expanding? Because I know so many people who are interested in textile, like who are into knitting or who are into so many things. So it seems surprising to me that the field of research is not bigger, but is it still quite small? Is it increasing? How does that work?
Yeah, it is thankfully growing because of the work we also do to express our work and tell other researchers how important it is. But I think the main issue is because we are so few people also in all of the European countries is because you cannot study textile archaeology at any university. If you study archaeology, you will not be taught anything about textile research or about organic preservation of archaeological finds because it is such a difficult field. You know, you don't have so many possibilities to find organic material in archaeology. You have to have very special surroundings, not only salt mines, but for example, very dry, very wet, or very cold surroundings, and that is not always the case. So. Yeah. That is point number one. And point number two is that the textile archaeology is quite a new subfield in archaeology. I think from the 80s on, it started to grow also the interest in, okay, we not only want to have weapons and jewelry and all of the nice glittery stuff, but also some old rags. I think to recognize this also as an important feature of archaeology and research is quite new and still has to have a lot of work done. Yeah. To advertise the textiles in archaeology. But we are growing. I mean, a lot of people, as you said, are very interested in crafts. And yeah. I think this is always a good point to grab someone and to gain interest by hands-on material, because we all wear clothes. We all have to choose every day what I'm going to wear now.
And this is a very, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Very human thing, actually. And then you can create a connection to the people and say, okay, our research is important because we don't know how the people look like in prehistory at all, but we have some movies and series and they are not, you know.
Yeah, they're not great, are they? I remember the Viking TV show, everyone was like, you're all in leather and furs and like, oh, great. You might as well just put a horned hat on and there you go. But I wanted to ask you as well, Ronja. So you were talking about how it's kind of a growing field and stuff. So what kind of advice would you give to anyone who wanted to get into textile research? And also, like, what do you wish you'd known before you got into it?
Oh, yeah. You always have to keep in mind that this is actually a group work. You know, you don't work alone from, I mean, you do. You sit alone at your desk and you do your research. That's right. But you should not only do that. So you always have to go out, go to conferences, go to gatherings, connect each other also online. And we have a lot of working groups now. Also had some few European funded research groups from the Eurowep, for example. This was really good to also connect with younger scholars who may also not have the money to go to conferences because they cost a lot of money. Yeah. And to be supportive and to always ask questions. Don't hesitate to write an email or to write someone on the internet like, hey, I am interested in textile archaeology. What can I do? And then we can ask, okay, where are you? Who's the closest textile archaeologist near you? It's like a bit of a dating platform.
Should make an app, like Tinder, text Tinder.
Yeah.
Like,
something like that.
Yeah, but that's always like, you know, everybody is very helpful and all of the professors and the people who are lucky enough to work at universities and do textile research, we're all very open-minded and very welcome everyone who's interested in textiles. So you don't have to fear the hierarchies or if there is anything, you know, because I did. I was always afraid to ask professors and other people from other countries and universities for help because I didn't know if they thought I'm super stupid. But yeah, you have to leave your comfort zone maybe and dig into the research. Council, I'd say, but
yeah. Well, and is it that you all have, I'm thinking of it like a D&D campaign now, that you have like the textiles, you know, group going on a quest, so you have everyone, like the bard is a specialist in weaving and the wizard is a specialist in, I don't know, sewing or embroidery or something like that. Does everyone have a sort of very specific specialism? I mean, you, for example, you said you're looking at these textiles. Is there a particular kind of subtopic, I guess, that you're specialized in? Or that is that something as well that happens? It becomes very specialized, or do you have to be more broad because it's such a small group?
Yeah, it's a mixture, I'd say. We all have, I think, our specialty.
Yeah.
For example, mine is now the salt mine, but I also do a lot of spinning and weaving and also crafts. So I'm not good at every craft, but of course, we know each other pretty well because we are so few people in our research that we always have someone to ask, like, oh, okay, I know, like, for example, Katrin Kania is super good at tablet weaving and spinning. If I have an issue, I can always ask her. So, and we actually did like a side quest a few weeks ago in Italy because there was a winter school actually for students and they could apply for this winter school and they had 1 week of textile training from all of the specialists in textile research and craft from all of Europe. We all got invited and we could teach some courses especially for our most like craft or where we are good at. And these students really had the opportunity to get 1 week of packed courses and workshops and to learn everything that there is to know about textile craft. So that was the first time I think anything like this happened. And I was super, super glad to be part of this. And I was teaching a course about experimental archaeology for textile research and one for weaving on a warp-weighted loom. So, everybody was telling everything they knew just in a very, like a half an hour or was just 1 hour. But we tried to, teach the students everything we know. That was pretty fun. And I think great opportunity for all of us.
That's really cool. Yeah.
I love that kind of collective sharing of knowledge and things. Oh my gosh, I just realized, don't we need a loom of some sort for this? I think there might be one. We might have a spare table loom in the cupboard. Hang on, let me check. Okay, I double checked the cupboard and I can't find the loom in there. Maybe I can send a quick note to the Nones and see if they left us a loom to use.
Okay, that sounds like a good idea. While we're waiting for a reply from them, so Vranya, of course, we are a podcast talking about archaeology, but we are also a podcast that talks about fantasy and fantasy fiction, to be specific. So next important question, apart from, what's your archaeological specialism, is do you enjoy reading fantasy books?
Oh, I do, or more or less I did, actually. I'm a bit of ashamed to say that I haven't read a good fantasy book in a while.
No shame. No shame in that. To be fair, we have had so many discussions on this podcast as well and in the Archaeo Book Club about how you get to a point where you just don't have time anymore and you lose the motivation and ability. I mean, that's
the will. The will to live.
Into sort of getting back into reading. But yeah. So what kinds of fantasy books or series were you into when you were reading them?
Well, of course, I mean, I read all of the classics like The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. I really enjoyed these. And I think the last fantasy series I read was The Song of Ice and Fire until he stopped writing, of course.
I was about to say, I think I understand why you stopped reading fantasy.
I was very disappointed.
I think he's not going to pick it up, apparently. This is the whole thing. Like, he was like saying, no, he's not going to do it recently because he's writing something completely else. And it was for TV because he does a lot of TV script writing and stuff. And there was an idea that he's just basically not going to finish them.
What? Is because of the TV show, you think, as well? That
I don't know.
He's
I don't
like,
know.
Oh, well, that's fine. We'll just have it that end. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Wasn't it a super disappointing ending? I have to admit, I didn't watch it. But like,
yes, it was.
I've
was
heard
shit,
that it was a horrendous ending.
It just didn't quite make sense. You're like, oh, really? That's it? Really? Oh, come on. Like, I think everyone was really mad at it, so...
Yeah, especially if you read the books and enjoyed the story and all of the different storylines and everything that has built up, and then he finished writing and you only have the series left and then you watch the last episodes and you think like, what? I've spent so much time in reading and creating this world in my head and that's it.
Maybe was it that he like that was his anticipated ending, and so the fact that it then got such backlash from everyone, maybe then he was like, oh.
It maybe, but he said when it first, like when they were doing the seasons outside of the books, they were like, oh no, it's not going to be anything like the books, like the books are completely different. So I don't know, I think he just lost interest. I think he's just got that bit of like, nah, I just don't have the dopamine to continue this anymore.
Oh well. Okay, well, so that one.
So now we are a Game of Thrones podcast.
Yes. No, it's fine. I think actually you might be the first guest that we've had who's brought up Song of Ice and Fire.
Oh, okay.
As a book. I don't know. Do you know, Ash? Have we had any other?
I think James, did James not bring it up?
Ah, yes, probably.
Yeah, in the Arrow episode that we did.
Yes, that's very true.
But yeah, no one's ever talked about it in depth. No, actually. Yeah, so there we go.
And were you always then into like epic series? So it would have to be like you mentioned, so far you've mentioned Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones, which are both like two of them. Did you ever read like Wheel of Time? Like are you into this sort of big...
Oh, I've read also some German fantasy books because I'm from Germany, and I really enjoyed also some, like there's the Tintenherz trilogy. I don't know if there's an English version of it, but they also made a movie out of it.
Inkheart, with the
Inkheart.
Book?
Yeah, Inkheart.
Oh, yeah.
So Inkheart. So good. Yeah.
Yeah, and yes. I loved
it. We love Inkheart.
Teenager. I really loved it. And, you know, the Cornelia Funke, she's a very famous author in Germany, and she wrote a lot of different also fantasy books, and I really like her work. Also, if you're an adult, I mean, she's writing more or less for teenagers, but also if you're an adult, you can really enjoy the books and the words she is creating. I really like that.
Yeah. No, I liked her books. We actually... Yeah, when I was younger, I read quite a few of her books. She read one with dragons. I can't remember now what it was called, but I really liked that one as well. It was also very good. Anyway, but nice, but cool. So, yeah, good to hear that you have. We have a fantasy aficionado then here, it sounds like, with a background in fantasy, if
yes.
not up to date with current reading, perhaps. But I was wondering then if we should do our fantasy literature review.
Yes.
Yeah.
Has anyone read any fantasy books that feature weaving?
Yeah.
So, funnily enough, when we were thinking about this episode, I was trying to think, and I was like, I swear I can remember one, because the reason I first got into weaving was through reading a book, a fantasy book, when I was younger, and I found it. It's called The Magic in the Weaving. By Tamora Pierce, who was one of my favorite authors when I was younger. So yes, The Magic in the Weaving. So it's book one of the Circle of Magic series, which is really cool anyway. It's like four young mages that meet each other and have to learn about their skills and everything. And so there's four books in the series, and each book follows like one of the mages. And the first one is called Sandrilena Fartorin, otherwise known as Sandri. So she comes from like a bit of a posher background than some of the others. Like I think one of them's a thief and one of them's like an outcast and all this sort of thing. But she has weaving gifts, and she like weaves threads, and she can capture light in the thread. Like at some point, spoiler alert, go forward a minute. Like towards the end, she also is able to even like spin water, like she does her spinning, like spindle wheel spinning, in order to like lift it out and save people.
Well, she's
from
a spinner and a weaver.
All this kind of thing. Exactly. Yeah. She does it all. So yeah, it's very cool. And there's a lot of little references to like the different ways that she is spinning and braiding and weaving and everything. So yeah, that's quite a cool one about it. And it's all the different ways she like captures things within the weaving, so she can like capture light in the weaving and all of this kind of stuff. It's very cool.
That is quite cool. See, that's a theme, I think, with fantasy novels. It's magic. Weaving is magic.
Yeah.
Which I quite like, actually. So I was thinking of, there's a few that I thought of actual weaving, but I'll talk about those in a sec. But then I thought of The Book of Life by Deborah Harkness in the Old Souls trilogy, because this is also a spoiler, because this is the third book. So spoiler alert.
We need to make a spoiler buzzer.
We do. But basically, Diana Bishop, who's like a witch that is from the long line of Bishop witches, she is a weaver. That is a subcategory of witch, where she can make her own spells, and she actually pulls from the threads of life and magic. And you like, it's also in the TV show, actually. You see it actually as threads, and that's how it's described in the book. And then, yeah, she can sort of basically like weave knowledge, history, and magic all together. Because she's also a historian, because, like, why not? So that's one I was thinking of. Then the Wheel of Time kind of has something similar too. But then I thought of the weave in D&D as well. The weave is literally the magic system.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's called the weave.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. There you go.
Yeah. So, but the ones I was thinking of that actually have weaving in them, one I've read, one I haven't read. It's on my TBR, which is never ending. But the first one was Daughter of the Forest by Juliet Mariner. And it's based off Celtic mythology, especially Irish mythology, about kind of the swan myth. But it's about a girl called Saoirse, and she has to save her brothers from turning into swans because her evil stepmother. I know, right? So annoying. Feathers everywhere. But like her evil stepmother does it.
Of course.
And she must weave 6 shirts from starwort, which is a brittle needle-like plant that causes pain. So basically whenever she works with it, her hands wrinkle and then they actually deform as well because she's in so much pain. But then if she speaks, the curse is eternal and her brothers will remain as swans forever. So she's not allowed to speak throughout the whole thing as well.
Oh, that sounds
pretty horrifying.
Almost like a German fairy tale.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So cruel.
It is really cruel. She goes through hell, bless her. She
goes through hell. Yeah. She's a lovely sister who saves her brothers and then she's deformed and her hands fall off and her
she appears in the other books as well. There's like a series.
Oh.
But she just doesn't really speak because she's so used to like not speaking.
She's just weaving intensely in the background. Yeah.
Just like going for it. But it shows you like the very much all the steps of her weaving, you know, her actually working with the plants and then turning it into, you know, fabric and then, you know, the washing and everything like that. I don't think she dies. I think they're just clean.
Okay.
But I mean, you wouldn't want to go into that much depth when your brothers are literally swans.
Right? Be like, maybe I'll use the madder red.
Like, maybe some woad in there. I don't know.
thoughts. Also, I'm just remembering one that came up in the book club actually at some point called The Weaver and the Witch Queen. Genevieve Gornicek?
Yeah.
Apologies, Genevieve, if you're listening to this podcast. And we'll mispronounce your name. But I haven't read it. I don't know if either of you are familiar with that one or if you know. Is that also that's fantasy, right?
It's kind of like a Viking fantasy.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of semi-historical, semi-like Norse ancient mythology kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But basically, I haven't read it. It's on my TBR. Yeah, that's the one I was talking about. It's on my TBR. It always is. But I did read The Witch's Heart, which was her Agrabora one, which is very good. I would recommend it. It's not weaving, though. And basically, The Weaver and The Witch Queen, it's something to do with like sisters. There's three, I can't remember if it's three sisters or two sisters and one friend or something. But basically, they have to navigate life. And one of them is a weaver, I believe. But like it actually shows you like changing from, you know, she's going through her whole life and the different, there's a prophecy with the weaves. I think the Norns are in it. Like it's, yeah, one of those kind of cool one-off fantasy novels that you can really sink your teeth into.
Well, and because you mentioned the Norns then again, because I guess we were sort of saying that as well, right? A lot of fantasy seems to be about it weaving in magic and all this thing. But I think like mythology, it's always again about, like you mentioned with D&D as well, right? It's sort of this idea of the threads of life or the threads of fate or something like that. It's kind of weaving is power as well, which I find really interesting that that's so embedded in mythology.
Yeah, like we control the destinies of gods and mortals and life. It's very self, you know? Yeah, there is. There's several different types of weavers in lots of different mythologies. So we've already talked about the Norns, which I don't know if everyone's figured out. It's Norse mythology. It's the three kind of women who weave the threads of fate. And again, like I said, they control the mortals. They measure and cut the threads of life and weave it and spin it. You've also got the Fates, the Moirai in Greek mythology, which are literally, they're very similar actually. And they determine the length of every person's being in existence. I feel like if anyone has watched like the 1994 Hercules,
I was about to say, I'm just thinking, what's wrong with these scissors? The thread won't cut.
That's exactly it. Yeah, and then you've also got Arachne, from Greek mythology, who's the mortal weaver who challenges the god Athena, but is then transformed into a spider.
I was about to say, must be something to do with a spider, right?
Like, yeah, and that's why weavers are so, I used to work at a weaver's cottage. And I learned a lot about weaving there, but we always used to keep the spiders because they're weavers too.
Yeah, that's adorable.
Yeah, they're little weavers. Yeah, so they were just living in the cottage a lot of the time. These huge, terrifying spiders. But then there's also like a lot of Greek myth. I think Penelope as well. She uses the act of weaving to delay remarrying, and
just because she's taking so long to weave.
So basically, it's Odysseus's wife, and when he's on
Can't marry you now. I have another three lines to do.
Yeah. Oh no! She doesn't need to. She doesn't want to remarry.
Warping thing.
I'm so sorry. But that's actually a tapestry. I think. I don't think that's actually. Like, she's not weaving.
Really takes that long, actually. I mean, if you're doing tapestry and more patterned textiles,
It takes a while.
Good to know.
It also, every night
she... marrying someone.
I know, and every night she unpicks it as well, so...
No, I wasn't happy with it.
Yeah. And it seems to be, like, predominantly a female skill as well, because the guys come in who want to marry her, and are like, oh, well, she's still not done yet. Ugh. And they just never notice that she's, like, unpicked everything that she's done that day. Which I think is very interesting.
I did.
But I mean, it lasts her 20 years. So like she does get there in the end.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good procrastination.
Yeah.
Very expensive fabric. You know, if you count the working hours, I mean...
Yeah.
Oh, I know. Oh, gosh, goodness. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Small business dream, right? Just spend 20. It takes me, you know, it costs that much because it takes me effing hours.
Yeah.
Effing years.
Yes. Absolutely.
I remember as well, you mentioned the spider. Isn't there, I think it's in one of the First Nation mythologies, I can't remember which one, in North America, there's also... like basically Spider Woman, which sounds like a superhero, but like also basically is a spider, but it's a sort of spirit person, and it makes she then weaves the web of life and everything.
Oh, that's cool.
As well, which is quite cool. So is similar to what we were saying before, like connects everything together and sort of, pulls all the threads and all of that kind of thing. So sort of almost like a creator figure, like a mother creator. Type of thing, which is
that's really interesting. And I find as well, like all these myths about weaving, they always symbolize these kind of like cosmos and a unified and like harmonious world, but then also they're all women. They never seem to be men.
Right?
Yeah. And,
I mean, Rania, is that kind of also in sort of history and archaeology, is it mainly a female task? Do we assume it's a female task, or is there evidence?
Yeah, I mean, I'm totally not surprised at all in mythology and stuff, like the textile crafts is connected to women. We can see this not as clear in prehistory because sometimes we also lack evidence and sources, for example, written sources or picture sources. But we find textile tools, for example, in female graves more often than in the graves of men. So there's always the hint of, okay, find spindleworts or maybe also distaffs and loom weights. Also not only as a tool itself, but also maybe as something part of their identity and social status also. Mm-hmm. For example, for the Iron Age, we have also depictions on Situla art. When women are doing any tasks, it's either weaving or spinning. Huh. And so we see that this is a common task. You have to do this very often because you want to dress yourself and you need clothing, but you also have the value of textiles for trading. So it either, you know, can be both. It can be an everyday task, but it can also be part of, you know, your social status, and I express how important I am through my tools. And these are textile tools. So, it later changes probably a bit in time. We see a connection of women in textile crafts until more or less the High Middle Ages, especially in Germany. And then later it changes that textile crafts, for example, specialized weavers, tend to be men from from the 14th century, especially in northern Germany, when the Hanse was quite active. But until then, it is thought that this is a more of a woman women specialized field, but you know, we don't know for sure, of course, like in all of the archaeologists.
As with all of prehistory, yes. Of course, we could never say for certain. Don't quote me on that.
It's always, it could have been, you know?
It could have been. Evidence suggests that.
Yeah.
Which I find interesting, though, that like, it's, you know, it's sort of always derided as like, ah, but that's women's work or, you know, da, da, da. And yet in all these mythologies, it's so essential for life. Like, it's such a powerful thing, and it's always women who are doing it. So it's this idea of like, oh, women were always seen as weak in history and prehistory. It's like, were they? Like,
but it is really powerful, because especially when you're saying that, it becomes more of a male skill. The same thing happens in Scotland, but more towards the 17 and 1800s. And you find that men are taking on these skills, but the very title of like spinster is, she's a spinner. That's her whole job. And she means that she has her own business. She's able to not be tied down to a man and doesn't need necessarily a man for financial stability. So that in itself is power in a time when, you know, Victorian values are high and a woman on her own is seen as bad, essentially. That is powerful, like to have that skill and that technology behind you to own your own loom or your own spinning wheel. There's something about that.
Oh. Huh, what's that? I thought the pigeon post had already been posted today.
Oh, that must be the loom arriving from the Norns.
Ah, that was super speedy. It's almost like they know the future. We should really get this all set up. How about we cut short this episode of Am I Trowel? But don't worry, everyone, we'll be continuing the next episode with part two. In the meantime, as always, please do follow, like, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Also, don't forget to get in touch if you have any suggestions for any future episodes that you might have. Maybe there's, I don't know, something that you want to explore further in a fantasy book from an archaeological perspective, or there's maybe an archaeological concept that you don't really understand that we can help you explore further through fantasy. All of our contact information, as well as all of the links to things that we've mentioned today for both us and also contact information for Ronja, can be found, as always, in the show notes.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.